Welcome to First Impressions, the podcast where we talk about our love for Jane Austen and give a big middle finger to all the haters. I am Kristen and I am joined by co-host Maggie.
Hello.
And today we are also joined by our dear, dear friend, Lexi. Hi, Lexi.
Hi.
Yay. Hello, Lexi. Well, hello, Lexi. Well, it's nice to have you back where you belong.
Beautiful.
Thank you.
I was not expecting that. I was just not expecting that, choice. Lovely.
Yep. Old school. All right. Okay. Hot take. We're talking about hot takes today. So Carol Channing or Barbra Streisand for Hello, Dolly. Quick, go. Choose.
I don't know. I'm not familiar with either.
Oh my God. Why don't I have any gay men on this podcast? Lexi, do you have an opinion?
I haven't seen Hello, Dolly in its entirety, but Barbra Streisand is a beautiful woman.
Yeah.
And you know, just based everything on that.
Like Carol Channing is iconic. She was still playing the role in like her 80s or 90s.
Oh, wow.
But I mean, I just love Barbra Streisand. All right. What's the task at hand, Kristen? What are we discussing today?
Oh, I'm so excited. I've been waiting for this for so long, ever since we talked about it. So Lexi, my close, dear friend from Twitter, who I am meeting for the first time.
We don't say Twitter anymore.
Oh, yes. I've been making that mistake on Twitter. Anyway, it's X now. It's zombie land. If you spell zombie with an X, that's what I've decided to call it in my head. No, I guess. Yes, but no, we met on Twitter when it was the OG and we have been just like tight ever since on Twitter. Everything that Lexi says about Jane Austen and her books opens up a new dimension for me of I never thought of it that way. And that is just such a fresh take. That is sometimes it's a hot take. They're all hot takes. Let's be honest. And so it's great to be able to talk in person, like in real time, about just your thoughts. And we were just talking about Mansfield Park. I know you have a ton of Mansfield Park takes, but you're also reading Northanger Abbey, right, Lexi?
Yeah, well, I just finished. I finished it a couple of days ago. The mood struck and I go with my moods.
So I saw your tweets on that as well.
Yeah, and that was fun because like I am kind of known as the John Thorpe enjoyer on Twitter.
The John Thorpe enjoyer has
that's already a hot take.
It is. I know it is. I've baffled many people.
John Thorpe apologist. Listen, he's just misunderstood, okay? He's just has social anxiety.
And here's the thing, right, is I don't even take that route. He is horrible. He is the worst. And I love him for it. I don't want to.
You know what?
Him.
That's fine.
I just want to keep him in a little jar and like feed him lettuce and just like, you know, he's just.
Listen, if you got Tom Hiddleston to play him, I'd be all on board. Right.
This has changed.
Hiddleston would be. He's too pencil-y, I think.
Oh, no, I was just going with a like Loki's supposed to be a villain, but because it's Tom Hiddleston and he's so like charismatic and wonderful, everybody just like is in love with Loki.
You know who you need is a male meatball, like from Jersey Shore, like a male Snooki, like body, like, yeah, like you just like the meatball is who John Thorpe is. He's a little bit greasy. You know, he definitely is described as having the dad bod going on.
Okay. Oh my God. Northanger Abbey, modern adaptation, Jersey Shore.
Like it's set in Jersey. That would be amazing.
It's set in New Jersey.
Lexi changed my brain chemistry. I was on the Twitter one day and saw her very first like John Thorpe tweet. And I was like, why do I get it? Something about the way you express what you were expressing. And then I went on to Tumblr, which was actually like when everything started to fall apart Elon wise, right? I was like, I need to make a Tumblr account. And one of the first things I saw on Tumblr was this cute little, it was almost like a line drawing, like an MS Paint. And it was a cute little person reclining on a bed with like rose petals all around and a heart, like a pink heart. And like this expression of just gooey sort of love. And over it was written in text, garbage men. Like the way, it was like the way that person felt about garbage men or trash men, something. And I was like, yes, yes. When we moon around for trash men, we've all had this experience. We were all young once.
I can change him.
I'm still young. I'm still mooning over trash men.
Okay. So is this our first hot take? Is just that you really love John Thorpe.
It is kind of, I guess, a hot take in that, like, you know, I think he's great. He's like my favorite Jane Austen character, which I know is like, a lot of people be like, how dare you? But she writes a good villain. She writes a good crummy guy. I love reading his dialogue. It's so great.
Like, to unpack it more, like, too, like, when you read his dialogue, is it something about you in relation to him, or just like a general appreciation for his portrayal?
I guess it is an appreciation for his portrayal, because it's like, you know, you can just throw his dialogue out, no context. You know who it is.
Yeah, yeah.
You know who's saying those words. It's so recognizable. And, you know, I've just always enjoyed characters like that just like are chaotic. Like,
is he chaotic evil or chaotic neutral?
Oh, he's definitely chaotic evil. He is absolutely chaotic evil. But like, it's just like it's not that he lies. It's the lies he chooses to tell, right? Like,
how they're pretty easily disproven. Like, it's not, there's not a lot of effort. All you have to do is talk to one person. And it's like, wait, that's totally wrong.
Exactly. It's like, he'll tell, what's his name? General Tilney, that like, oh yeah, Catherine's wildly rich and she has this great benefactor and she's going to inherit the Allen's vast fortune. And then the next time he sees them, just because Catherine like rejected him, he's like, actually, she's poor as hell. She's basically homeless. She is the poorest person you've ever known. It's just amazing.
However he feels, it's just what he says. He's just living in his own reality, like guided by his own wishes and desires.
He's just all id.
Who can't relate to that? Yeah, he's all id. Yeah, he's not like a Voldemort situation. It's not like he's, you know, sees himself as this agent of evil. He has no impulse control and he's not that bright.
He's a toddler.
He likes what guys like. He likes the horses and the carriages, and he just wants to bro out and also get rich by marrying a rich woman.
I feel like he would translate really easily to a modern adaptation.
Yeah, actually, he would be a Jersey Shore character.
Very easily. Like, I was thinking that this read-through, I was like, this is a man I've met. Like, I know this guy. He is a tech bro. He is a car guy. He is like, he still exists. That's for sure. And I want to make it clear, I don't think he'd be great in real life. I wouldn't want to like date someone like John Thorpe. I enjoy him because he's fictional, right? Because like there's no threats there.
There's no threat.
Real guys like that, not great. Like Elon Musk is very John Thorpe-ish, right? And I despise him.
Is John Thorpe like one of the original himbos?
You know, you have to have like a heart of gold to be a himbo. So I wouldn't classify him as a himbo, but he is definitely under that dumb man umbrella.
There's a whole, like, there's various subgenres.
Yeah.
All right, what else have you got for us, Lexi?
Okay, so I suppose
we built it up, so these better be like really good.
Be good. So I suppose the hottest take I have for Mansfield Park is that I think Fanny Price is in fact the villain of the story.
Oh, I love this.
Ooh.
Take us on this journey.
Obviously, well, now I'm like, is Fanny Price, like, she's not literally the narrator, but like everything's from her point of view. So it's like, is she an unreliable POV? Well,
I wouldn't say she's unreliable. I think she is pretty reliable if you understand where she's coming from, right? Mm-hmm. Like if you understand, for instance, her background, which is why Austen gives you all her background. I think that's obviously deliberate. And yes, she is the protagonist of the story. And, you know, as we learned from grade school English, protagonist does not mean hero. Protagonist is just the main character of the story. But yeah, I mean, the entire book is kind of her like corruption arc. So she kind of starts out as like, you know, the poor relation who's very put upon, and it's a very pitiable depiction. But, you know, she is living in the lap of luxury, even if she's treated rather badly. And she really, really values that, kind of to the detriment of everything else, including her own well-being. And when I talk about the detriment of everything else, I do also mean, for instance, the kind of economic issues, right? Mm. The slavery and everything. She is a little bit of a mouthpiece to kind of discuss why, like, slave labor is bad. But overall, she really values the tranquility of Mansfield Park and everything that it does for her. And so that's why I think that she is... That is why she marries Edmund in the end. Like, not Ooh. From a character's motivation perspective, but from a story perspective, right? Edmund is, for all intents and purposes, the one who's going to inherit Mansfield Park, right? Tom Bertram is kind of a non-starter. And he's going to pretty much be the one in charge. So Fanny is essentially putting herself in the place to become the next Mrs. Bertram. quite literally. And so, you know, you really see how, and maybe it is an effect of the bad treatment, but it just kind of breaks her down and makes her submit to Mansfield Park, right? And Mansfield Park itself is a very overbearing and kind of oppressive thing, like an entity almost.
So instead of a corporate shill, she becomes a landed gentry shill.
Exactly.
Can I talk about why that just... some things, why this makes so much sense to me that I was just thinking about, because I couldn't agree more, that she grows to really value the wealth and the tranquility that it produces, right, of Mansfield Park. I have so many thoughts about this. The first was that she is always tired and feeling bad, like she's just not in great health. She's not really built for that struggling in Portsmouth lifestyle anyway, right? And when she goes back there, I think one of the reasons she longs for it so badly is because her physical health is breaking down under Portsmouth. And that's actually explicitly said, right? The headache, she can't eat the food. She's grown to appreciate the wealth of Mansfield Park, even though it does come from this slave labor, and it did put her in this position of being essentially Sir Thomas trying to sell her to Henry Crawford for his own benefit. Edmund is like the moral inheritor of Mansfield Park, a person who's going to support the existing moral order, Church of England, definitely the tranquility. You know, when Edmund is, it says at times, like he's too angry to speak. It's like, you keep your feelings inside. You don't speak of them. That's the way we live. And Fanny at another time, she's like, I know I shouldn't have gone to the rehearsal. I know it would disturb my tranquility. Like, because that's what everybody values, yeah, right, in Austen's time. And it does feel wrong to us with our current day values. She's not able to speak up against anything, nor does Edmund want her to, right? So now I'm just kind of petering out, but that really struck a chord, that she's not in a position, nor does she ever like take any kind of, you know, like we said in our last podcast, she's not able to follow through with any kind of justice arc. Mm-hmm. For anyone else but herself, right?
If this was a modern story, at the end she would like stand up for herself and be like, no, but it wouldn't be just be like this quiet sort of strength. It would just be like a big monologue where she like tells everybody off, right?
And here's the other thing too, like her strength is in support, it almost works against her strength in her convictions, the convictions that she's inherited from Mansfield, actually probably blocks her from getting a life where she could be intellectually stimulated in a different way. She could mm-hmm. be happy with Henry Crawford. He's so personable. He's opened a door to a different life and she doesn't go through it. And I know we all feel like conflicted about that to an extent. I don't know how you feel, Lexi, about Henry Crawford and her potential future with him, or
I am conflicted about it because, like, on the one hand, it kind of doesn't matter to me because for me, that's not what Mansfield Park is about, right? It's not about the romance. There is romance in it, but it's not about that, right? It's like Henry Crawford represents a path that Fanny can take, and she chooses not to. And in fact, she never really was all that tempted to. Mm-hmm. Like, her loyalties lie with Mansfield Park. They always have, they always will. And Henry's attentions are nice because she's never really been treated well. But, you know, it's just that lifestyle of his is chaotic, and that can't work in the orderly world of Mansfield, right? And that's just not something that appeals to Fanny. And yeah, so for me, it's like, on the one hand, I understand why everybody's like, she should have gone with Henry. And I love Henry. He's got big bi energy. I love it.
But, he does.
But to me, like, Mansfield Park is so allegorical in a way that, like, other Austen stories aren't, that, like, I don't know. I'm like, yeah, Henry represents certain things, and there's a reason why Fanny doesn't go with him. So,
yeah, I think that's very insightful.
Sorry. All right. Yeah. What kind of, no, I need to know, like, as the villain, what villainous, like, outcomes, other than the ones we've already talked about, like, do you think she's a villain for keeping Edmund and Mary apart?
Oh, no. That's another kind of, like, that's another, like, the Mary Edmund thing is another, like, you know, another path not taken, right?
Yeah. For
Edmund.
Yeah.
Mary and Edmund was just a red herring.
Kind of. And, you know, it's like, and that's really cool about the Crawfords, and to an extent, Tom Bertram, is like, they're these little tadpoles of chaos that come into Mansfield, right? And they do all these wild and crazy things while they're there. And Edmund himself is quite tempted by Mary. He does almost marry her.
Yeah, she's hot as hell.
God, yes. But, you know, once again, it's that sort of thing where, and part of that is Fanny's doing, right? She is kind of the one that kind of not necessarily convinces him not to be with Mary, but, like, kind of shows him, right? Like, these are our principles. This is Mary. This doesn't work. And eventually Edmund kind of comes to see that, especially after the Mariah incident, right? So where was I going to go with that? Edmund, Mary. Fanny is a villain. So what her villainy is, right, is in the continuation of Mansfield Park. Because what we see with Tom Bertram especially is Tom Bertram is a disruptive force, right? He spends so much that he has actually forced his father to sell off the parsonage, right? Is that what happened?
Yeah. The living of Mansfield itself, yeah.
Yes. He has to sell that off, right? Because he needs the cash to pay for Tom. Potentially, if Tom was the one to inherit Mansfield Park in that state, he would run it into the ground. He would destroy it. You know, this thing that's been built up on slave labor, on all these kind of corrupt principles and stuff like that. And he could just...
It would get broken up into pieces, then the developers would come in, and then you'd end up with all these McMansions that are thrown up for like $5 and sell for $1 million. There's no low-income housing.
Potentially. He could. I don't know. That's more... No low-income housing is more Mr. Knightley's foray.
Yeah. Oh, damn! Shots fired! no low-income housing and 15-year-old girls.
We will get to that. I have a rant, but anyways. Right, so the fact that, you know, he is kind of set aside, and that his kind of, I'm going to call it a redemption arc in, like, the worst possible way.
Yeah.
Is so... I call it inhuman in the sense of, like, that's just impossible, right? A guy like that on that trajectory is not going to just fall down with a cold and then come out of it and be like, actually, daddy, you're right about everything. Like,
what if there's a shadow plot, though? We'll have to talk to to Arnie. What if he just, like, what if he had, like, gonorrhea or syphilis or something like that?
I mean, yeah. It's entirely possible that
or Hep C,
what's going on,
or, you know,
you know.
Just saying.
I'm just saying, you don't just fall over and then you're like almost dead like that. Anyway. But, you know, his transformation is not natural.
Convenient. It also feels kind of, I mean, that seems like also kind of an Austin thing, right? Like sometimes things just like towards the end.
Yeah. I mean, obviously she does use some contrivance in a lot of ways. That's kind of what every author has to do, right? Yeah.
It's like, you know what? This has already been long enough. Like people don't care about Tom. Like, let's just say that he got sick and then like, he's fine.
But I think it's actually deliberate. I think it's meant to be that like this chaotic force has been tamed, right? Mm-hmm. And then the Crawfords are expelled. That chaotic force has been done away with. So the tranquility of Mansfield Park is maintained. And then the two people are going to be in charge of it are Fanny and Edmund. And so they are just going to continue with this really dark, horrible legacy.
Status quo, yeah. Park.
Exactly.
I like this. I like that. That's very interesting. It's a lot to think about.
Yeah, that's why it kind of like the last couple of lines of Mansfield Park are like, they give me chills. It's like the ending of a horror movie to me. Like, it's just, oh God.
But maybe that actually would help people understand Fanny more. Like, I think it helps me understand Fanny more because as a modern reader, we've talked about this a lot. Like, we struggle to accept Fanny as the protagonist and the heroine. But if you like kind of turn it and be like, no, she's actually representing like the continuation of this sort of like legacy that should be rejected. That's much more interesting.
I think so. And I think there's precedence for that, you know, like how Mansfield Park was not very well accepted at all when it was published and pretty clearly ignored, like deliberately by reviewers and the well-to-do and everything like that.
What do you mean? Don't you think people want to hear that their way of life is unsustainable?
Oh, God. Yeah. So, you know, that's how I interpret Mansfield Park, which is why, to kind of circle back to your last episode, I think the 1999 movie is a barely really, really bad adaptation, but I do think it's a pretty good movie.
I do think though, what you were saying about how like they sort of banished the chaotic elements, because we had just watched it. I was thinking about the scene at the end where those crazy kids finally get together. It's them like sitting on a bench outside, like quietly reading. And that does kind of play into what you were saying, where like every action Fanny took was about like getting that vibe back, that like tranquility, just like being with Edmund, like her quiet life. Mm-hmm. And she totally gets it, right?
So, yeah. Lexi, I remember when you watched that movie like fairly recently for the first time, right? Mm-hmm. And yeah. I remember reading your like live tweets about it and kind of the, because I know way before that, we had had sort of a conversation about racism in the Austin fandom and Mansfield Park. And I remember seeing your tweets and they were lots of like capital, like, oh my God, why didn't you guys tell me about this movie? Is that like I can't believe how far they went into the slavery subtext there. Was that your reaction?
Yeah, I didn't realize it was so overt. Like, first of all, nobody talks about this movie, like in this day and age, in like current Austin discourse, which is pretty shocking because, you know, there has been a lot of discourse about racism in the Austin fandom specifically. Yeah, like nobody talks about it. So like, I didn't realize how overt and like how to the forefront the director and the screenwriter made it, which I enjoy that. I'm glad they did because I do think how it's presented in Mansfield Park is quite subtle. And, you know, I'm not going to say moviegoers aren't going to get it, but like, you got to, you know, make sure that you can pick up the message in the first go around is what I'm trying to say here.
Yeah. Yeah. So she did make it very overt. I feel like I've heard too that some people really, it was very early on, right? It was 1998, but it was probably one of the first references to even the fact that people of color exist in an Austin adaptation.
Mm-hmm.
And that even meant something, even though, you know, it's bringing in sort of a not happy storyline. Like, I know we talked a lot about, you know, just in general, fandoms have talked a lot about Black joy and the need to represent that. I mean, but this was like a very early on, like, hey, it even exists kind of a thing. And that was important to people, as I understand why it would be, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I know there are people of color and specifically Black people in earlier Austin productions, but they are very much relegated to the background. Usually they're servants or just like extras. Or in the case of the 1986 Northanger Abbey, a slave child?
Yeah, a page boy. Yeah, slave page boy. This was a trend. This is,
yeah.
Yes. And I guess whoever made that movie was just like, had done their historical homework and they were like, let's do this wild thing where there's another sax solo and a child doing cartwheels. I don't know, man. It is weird, but it is there. It's like, okay, you know, now we're doing this now.
Yeah.
It's very much that movie's vibe.
I am ready for another hot take, Kidney.
Okay. Let's see. So, well, talking about the 1986 Northanger Abbey, I think it's actually better than the 2007 Northanger Abbey.
Is that the one with the crazy soundtrack?
Yes, that's the one with the crazy soundtrack.
Hell yeah! Yeah,
I love that.
Not to that part. It was bonkers.
Yeah, it's great.
Wild. So I think that because I have beef with Andrew Davies, I'm going to be upfront about that. I have many problems with him. I would give him a talking to if I were to meet him.
good for you.
That you say that, but I'd be like, oh, Mr. Davies, I'm such a fan.
I
don't
know. I probably, honestly, if I actually saw him in real life, which I don't know what he looks like. But
yeah, I don't know what he looks like either.
I do. He's really old. He's extremely old.
Would probably just
if
not
I,
say
Kristen, I swear to God, if I look this up and he's like 60, I'm going to be so mad at you for being like, oh,
no,
I saw him.
No, I'm doing it right now. How he's old like is a Andrew? Super old British
I'm
guy.
I'm going to live fact check. Because, how old
so
is Andrew Davies?
I don't think you could get too mad at
he
him.
He does look pretty old. Oh, shit, he's 86. Okay, that's valid.
I think because he's so old and like slightly like you wouldn't. I mean, when you see interviews with him, you're like, we're not going to have Andrew for much longer. So I don't know.
They say hello to his face.
No, I think that.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Oh, my God. Did he write the original House of Cards?
He might have.
Oh,
he's
shit.
Done a lot of screenwriting. Yeah.
Wow. All right. Okay.
And that's to say, right? Like, I don't think he's not talented. I think he's brilliant in what he does. But the choices he makes, I find questionable in regard to Austin. But
you can't even say okay, boomer, to him. He's so old. It's like, okay, silent generation. Like, what do you say?
So here's the thing, though, about him, though. He draws out some themes. Sometimes it doesn't work. Sometimes it is this amazing alchemy. Well, I think this is not my hot takes podcast, but in a sense that it's all my
hot. It's always your hot take podcast, Kristen.
The Northanger Abbey, the fact is he always wants to bring the sex out, right? But that worked so well for Northanger Abbey because that is the important subtext of that story is sexuality and, you know, discovering it and what does it mean and how does it come out in our expressions and how does it merge with horror? Like, you know, there's that element of it too, the danger of it. But anyway, so I thank Andrew Davies for being the chaos agent that sometimes brings these things to the forefront for like the modern audience.
Right.
Oh yeah. And I agree there. I think that's one of the high points of the 2007 for me is that sexual element.
The sex.
Like,
yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, you know, I mean, first of all,
yeah.
Just seeing Carrie Mulligan.
Yeah.
Bodies. Nice.
Yeah.
As a lover of women, I do enjoy that. But also,
she's so hot.
I am glad that he did bring that out, right? But I think he kind of takes the teeth out of Northanger Abbey, especially Henry Tilney. I almost said Crawford. Henry Tilney. because, you know, he kind of wanted to make him more, I think, more
modern,
good, more admirable than I think Henry Crawford really is. And I, dang, damn it, too many Henrys.
Yeah, there's a lot of Henrys. That's England, though.
I'm just going to call him Tilly. I'm not going to say Henry. I'm just going to call him Tilly. Hopefully, I won't get it mixed up then.
Mr. Tilly. Anyways. Just call him Mr. Tilly.
Mr. Tilly. Whereas I think that 86 version, or 87, whatever, 86, I think that actually draws out more of Tilney's, like, complacency in his family, right? Mm-hmm. Because you have the general who's, you know, the general, need I say more. And you have Captain Tilney, who is himself, you know, he's a flirt. He's really has no kind of reservations about flirting with an engaged woman, flirting around with women who are spoken for. And, you know, it's implied that he's done this many times before. And Henry Tilney is very much like, you know, that's what my brother does. And he knows the choices he's making.
He's not willing to stand up to anybody in his family. Oh my God, I'm totally blanking on the saying, the, like, something about his principles. What is it? Oh, the courage of his convictions. He doesn't really have the courage of his convictions. Nailed it.
There we go. Yeah, he really doesn't, right? Like, it's interesting because he is a clergyman. And you would
think, oh my God, at first I thought you said a virgin. And I was like, well, I mean, you don't know.
No, I don't think he's a virgin. Well, maybe. I don't know.
He's a clergyman. Oh my God.
He's a clergyman, right? So you might think he had something to say about his brother and his father acting in less than moral ways, but that's, he never really
point.
Does.
Yeah, that's a good
he's,
point.
He's very like, you know, that's the way it is. Another is character this, that's pretty okay with the status quo.
Is this really. Also another one of those like Austin moments where if someone had just said something, like a lot of trouble could have been averted? Like when he started sniffing around Isabella. If someone had been like, oh, hey, like that guy's like, don't, you know, for real, there's all these other ladies, like, don't do it. But like, nobody's ever willing to talk, right?
Yeah.
Nobody's exactly. ever willing to just say what happened.
Yeah. And like, it seems like Henry Tilney doesn't really seem to speak up to his father, at least until the very end. And I think what the general does to Catherine when he sends her home is the kind of thing that shakes Henry a little bit.
Yeah, well, devil's advocate, is that his arc? Oh. Like, does Catherine teach him how to be more courageous?
Oh. You know what? Maybe. What with her wanderings and everything.
Yeah, yeah.
She's willing face down the vampires. Like, you know.
She's very brave. She is very brave. But yeah, you know, I think it's that sort of thing where the general himself, right, you know, he is misusing his power as the owner of an estate. He has all this, like, and I know you guys have talked about the pioneery on here before, so I'm just going to assume all listeners understand the pioneery thing.
I'm sure everyone is familiar with our entire back catalog.
Yes. But, you know, you've got that issue. You've got how he has renovated and changed the Abbey and everything like that. It's more to his taste rather than making sure that his people are, like, you know, well taken care of. Like, right. He's clearly hurting the labor of his estate. And obviously Tilney has never, and this might be also in case of just never feeling empowered to speak against his father, because, you know, when the general's in the room, all the Tilneys are silent. Like, they are very clearly silent and
cowed by him. Yeah,
exactly. And so I think once Henry Tilney, sees that power used against somebody who is not of their people, I think that finally shakes him. And he's like, oh my God, like, this cannot continue like this, right? And so he does finally speak up to his father, and he does finally, like, go out and, like, try to make it right with Catherine and everything like that. So yeah, so I think Catherine does kind of is like the catalyst of that change in him, which is nice. as much as I don't like Henry Tilney.
It's so funny because in the entire book, it's a book about a young woman and her dependence on the framework provided by this older, more experienced man to show her the world in the way that it is. And of course, he's wrong about everything, except for, you know, maybe his mother being murdered. Seems like she's the one who's wrong about that. But
I just want to say, we don't actually know what happened.
Well, right. Yeah.
And what if hot take? That bitch was murdered. that's what happened. It's not like you've got, this is not Midsummer County. Like nobody's investigating.
Just it was in Badger's Drift. This is cute.
I mean, look at Henry's like defense to that, right? Is Catherine, we're in England.
Yeah, people nobody gets murdered in
England. Yeah, people don't. And I'm like, sir.
Like what?
Sir, you guys have the highest body count of literally any other country in the world, statistically. And we have handguns in this country, sir. And you still are dropping like flies here.
Wait, is that true, Maggie? Or are you just making
No, I just made that up. Joke. That's bullshit. Okay. No.
It's a Midsummer Murders joke.
All no, right. It's definitely us. It's Fake definitely news. Us, Kristen. I'm just making fun of all the murder mystery shows.
Okay.
Okay. Give me something else. Give me keep them coming. This is good. This is all good. It's feeding gold. Me.
It's gold.
Chris is awesome. Not going to have to edit anything. It's all staying in.
Okay. So, talked about the 86 Northanger Abbey. I don't know if I finished my thought on that.
Oh, sorry.
Let me just... Oh, yeah. So, like, that movie, right? It makes Northanger Abbey into an actual gothic story instead of what a lot of people say, which is that it's a satire of gothic. So here's my third hot take. I don't think Northanger Abbey is a satire.
It is just full on gothic.
Gothic story.
What is more gothic than a jazz saxophone?
That's true. I love the soundtrack of that film. But anyways, I think there are obviously satirical elements in Northanger Abbey, right? Like I'm not saying there's nothing like that at all. It is there. That's Austin being cheeky, especially young Austin being cheeky. But I think it's a modernization to her time of a gothic story, right? So it's not set back in the mists of time. It's not in a castle somewhere on the continent. It takes place right here in current year in our country, but it still has all the elements of gothic story in it, right?
You just said something that absolutely blew my mind.
Okay.
When you said... It's a, oh, so sorry, I have to recalibrate. So it's like when they made Emma into Clueless, Northanger Abbey is like the modern adaptation of the gothic.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah
actually, totally.
That's
yeah.
A great one.
And that's not a satire. Like Clueless is not a sat, it's a comedy, but yeah. I wouldn't say it's a satire.
Here's a mini hot take.
Okay. Yeah, I got it. Oh my God, girl. Shut my laptop. No.
Never.
I don't know why I haven't seen it.
Never. Let me Netflix party that shit. Let me see where it's streaming because I'll watch it with you. That'd be hilarious.
Yes.
All right. Anyway, I think that's brilliant. What you just said, I love that. It just totally like reframed it for me. It's like these like modern day Shakespeare. She just, oh my God, I love it. But it's so hard to, I never would have thought of that because modern, right?
Yeah.
But it's 1805. Exactly. But still, that's modern to them.
Exactly. That's contemporary to her time. I mean, you know, that's like anybody making a modern day adaptation of any of her works now. It's that
never
thing.
Occurred to me. Never, ever occurred to me, but I really like that.
Yeah. So I think that's really what it is. It's paying homage. It's, you know, it's got some jokes. It's got some laughs. It's got a little bit of that, but you know, she's got that defense of the novel in there. She's got this constant defense of fellow women writers in there. And it doesn't make sense that she would go to such trouble to defend the gothic, to defend female and sorry, I'll say women writers and then satirize them. Like that doesn't really connect for me.
Yeah,
it never really has.
True. That's
so
true.
Yeah. That's kind of how I interpret Northanger Abbey. And I think, looking at it that way, you know, it pulls out a little bit more because like you kind of look a little bit closer at Catherine and it's like, you know, yeah, she is naive and she may be a little bit unworldly when the story starts, but I don't think she is unintelligent. I don't think she's, you know, stupid in any way. She's actually quite smart. She figures things out pretty quickly. She makes connections. Her honesty like shines through in a world of artifice, right? And she just doesn't come off as like a satirical character to me. She comes off as a very earnest character and the kind of character that you put a lot of emotional investment in, even in such a short novel. So I also think that novel is incomplete. and the ending is a mess.
Yeah. And oh my God, this paper is due in 2 hours. I just have to make out an ending. Oh.
Yeah.
11:59 and I'm like hitting send to my professor.
It kind of is. It really does feel like Austin was like, I don't know how to end this, guys. So here's.
So everybody gets married. The God inherited and gets married. Is happy.
We everybody all ignores the general. Together to perfect felicity, right? Like, yes,
that's the track of my life.
I said what I needed to say. Here's some cute little things that happen, and now we're done.
I just love the very, very quick insert of Eleanor's love interest.
Oh yeah,
that apparently existed that whole
distant time. Relative dying and comes into a sudden inheritance. Oh great, perfect.
I'm like, she put a whole other novel into this
case. Yeah. What about that guy?
I also love the bit where she was like, you remember the laundry bills? Those are his. Like, what?
Yeah. What if that guy, oh my God, my mom brain. What's the guy from Emma who I'm like the apologist for that everybody hates?
Travis Birkenstock?
No.
Oh, you're talking about Emma, not Clueless.
That Ewan McGregor plays.
Oh, Frank Churchill.
Hey, what if he's like a Frank Churchill type and he's just like waiting for this relative to die?
Yeah, kind of. Yeah.
Probably.
He's just another one of those.
He's like, the proto Frank Churchill. Yeah. She had this whole epic backstory in her head.
It's like, who and Emma or who and Clueless are you an apologist
if,
for?
Man, I was. If just... Jane Austen was a modern writer after her books, would she have started like J.K. Rowling? Would she have started a website where she was like, and here's all the stuff I didn't put in the books? And she like tells all this like crazy backstory.
She might have, because she did that for her family. Apparently, I don't know how.
Pottermore.
But like, I have Austin heard Moore. That. She apparently told her family in like an evening when they were like sharing stories that she thinks that Jane Fairfax would have died an early death because of all the stress Frank Churchill
put her. Oh, no!
So I don't know if that's like real or accurate or if that's just like an apocryphal thing, but it is really funny to think about.
No, that's so awful. If that is true, I no longer am a Frank Churchill apologist. Took her to an early grave. Jesus. I don't like it. I just think Cassandra's like, Jane, you just have to tell me what happens to everyone. Well, Jane Fairfax dies. My God.
Yeah, so I feel like Austin would have loved Twitter. She probably wouldn't like X. She probably would have decamped to Blue Sky by now, but she probably would have loved Twitter.
She would have gotten a code like that. Like,
would she have also just made that up, like something terrible, just to like get a rise out of people?
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah. Jane Fairfax totally just dies a year later.
Yeah. Well, she would have been really annoyed by like the uncritical like love and acceptance for some of the characters she wrote. Like I am convinced she would be annoyed by readers who love Henry Tilney from the book because he is so misguided, wrong, in love with his own voice, etc. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, or maybe we're supposed to feel, and maybe she felt a little bit of that John Thorpe feeling for Tilney. Like, he's got all of these failings that a man mm-hmm. of his day would have in terms of this belief in his own infallibility and his own mental superiority. But absolutely. Just to have this fondness in your heart anyway for these garbage men. But there maybe. Can't be uncritical acceptance of him.
Just have to think about what Jane Austen would say after she saw Barbie.
Oh my God. Man.
Speaking of which, Kristen, are we going to do a Barbie episode?
Yes. So sorry, tangent Lexi for a second, but because there is a 1995 Pride and Prejudice clip.
It's canon now.
So yes, our next episode will be a Barbie episode. I feel like I have to see it again.
I have to go see it again. Yeah.
I have to. She's doing so many interesting things, but there is a bit of four-dimensional chess going on. And sometimes I like thought I understood what was happening, and then I lost the plot for a little while, and then I was like, okay, you know, it was so brilliant of her to show us a world in which the gender roles were completely flipped so that you sympathize with Ken. So all the men in the audience are sympathizing with Ken. And then maybe they came to this blinding realization that like, oh man, I wouldn't like it if I was in a woman's position in today's society. I don't know if any men got there after watching the movie. Probably they didn't, but I still was digging it. Anyway.
Okay. Tangent. Look forward to that. Yes.
More hot takes.
More hot takes.
All right. So, Mr. Knightley.
Yay.
This isn't even a hot take. This is just a fact. The man that was 30 years old and fell in love with a 13-year-old girl.
Didn't he?
Gross.
Yes. He says it outright. It's in the text.
But the way that we love changes. I don't know. What?
Look, you can make your excuses.
Yeah, I make jokes about pedophilia all the time. So funny.
He says he fell in love with her at 13 and he goes on to marry her.
Well, how old was he?
30. He was 30 years old.
When she was 13?
Yes.
That's nasty. He's going to be in that Sound of Freedom movie. They're going to send a U.S. Marshal out to arrest him.
Now that's spicy.
I just feel like pedophilia wasn't like an acknowledged problem.
I know, right? But that's what's so fucked up. As soon as you have a period, it's like, okay. I will just say, I think that's something he was trying to say that at the time would have seemed romantic to be like, well, I've loved you like my whole life kind of thing. It just like, unfortunately, is a super weird thing to say.
It's a weird thing to say. And I think, I don't know.
It's like a super weird way to put it.
Isn't it weird how Davies leans into it too? And he has Mark Strong say, I held you in my arms when you were a baby.
Yeah, why are you doing this?
I hate it.
Yeah.
I hate it so much.
Wait, is that Mark Strong? Really?
Yeah, Mark Strong says that, yeah, in the Davies Emma adaptation.
Is he Mr. Knightley? I don't remember.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
I hated that so much. I was like, why are you saying this?
I have to see what I haven't seen that one in a really long time.
Well, okay. And so like, so accepting your premise is I accept your premise, Lexi, that he maybe looking back realizes that he's in love. He has been in love with Emma since she was 13 by dint of fancying so many faults in her. But do you think where do you go with that from there? Or is that like, the take
that's the deal breaker.
That's kind of how I'm already looking at Knightley, kind of like side eyeing him, right? But then there's another weird, interesting little detail in Emma, which is that she was 12 when she became essentially the one who was in charge of
the household.
Hartfield. Yeah. Right, because that's when Isabella, her sister,
Isabella. Yeah.
These names, my God.
There's only five names.
That's when her sister gets married, is when Emma is 12. Hmm. And because their father is not in the sound mind, that means Emma's essentially running the household at 12.
Okay, now wait a minute. That's a hot take. Not of sound minds. A little harsh. He just gets cold.
Well, and I guess Miss Taylor is kind of there to hold down the fort, but Emma's got such a strong personality, she pretty much overwhelms Miss Taylor anyway.
So maybe she just like, maybe he appreciated her moxie, and I don't know.
Here, Emma, you deal with this.
Yeah.
I think Knightley falls in love with Emma because she is the one running the second largest estate in their county.
Mm. Yeah.
It's a whole financial thing, and he is in charge of so much. You see these kind of like little glimpses into the background of him like redoing the roads, and you see like attention is drawn to the poorest of the residents of
Highbury.
Thank you. You know, like you have Emma visiting the poor to feed them. You have the travelers who cause problems for Harriet. Oh man, I don't know why I'm struggling with the names tonight. And you see all these kind of like economic problems, right, in Highbury. And, you know, there's a whole thing about how Knightley is the one in charge of enclosing the land.
Yeah.
Which means that the land is no longer available for public use or common use, which means it harms the poorest the most. And of course, we see that the economically more prosperous people in Hartfield, in Highbury, are, you know, prospering all the more. The Coles, for instance,
are moving. Are you saying that he's just basically the little Monopoly man?
Yes, he's the little Monopoly man. And his, you know, kind of similar to General Tilney, similar to Mr. Bertram, Sir Thomas Bertram, whatever his name is, you know, his primary concern seems to be economic. He is looking to combine and consolidate the wealth, right? That's why he marries him. I mean, okay, he falls in love with her. I'm not saying he doesn't fall in love with her.
But well, he falls in love with her, but he also falls in love with like the prestige and power and money she represents. It's like a whole package deal.
Like there are a lot of available women that he has encountered in his 30s.
That aren't 12.
That aren't 12, but are probably plenty wealthy, right? But not that wealthy, and not specifically in Highbury. And so I think that's why he is like, you know, he kind of zeroes in on Emma as this is the woman, right? This will be the woman that I will marry if I were to marry. Yeah. It will be her.
Yeah.
So. Lexi, are there any Austin, I use the word heroes, but you know what I mean, that you do like?
You know, I really do go back and forth on them. I am a Darcy appreciator. So I think it's because he's the one that's like the most outright, like he goes through a lot of change and
he's super crabby in the beginning, which is always delightful.
It is. And, you know, and like, you know, he's legitimately an asshole, but you know, he changes for his own sake. And for doing that, you know, then he gets the girl and all as well.
Did you recently tweet something about like tired Darcy is autistic, wired, and that was the conclusion? It was something about, oh damn, so, I remember really liking it.
Yeah, it was broke Darcy is autistic because he's mean to people, woke Catherine is literally hyper fixating and info dumping and
oh yeah,
and is like awkward in social situations, like she is absolutely not just a girly.
Oh my God. I could totally, like, I'm having the same reaction again. Like, I remember smashing like right away and being like, oh my God, she is hyperfixating. She has this hyperfixation on the literature. And then, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. So I'm going to be really clear here because I am not somebody who subscribes to the headcanon that Darcy is autistic or neurodivergent. But, you know, it's a valid interpretation and I am autistic myself. So I'm not saying that as like, you know, somebody who's not autistic and doesn't get it.
I'm glad you said that because that is like the only way it's okay to make that joke.
That's true, huh? I should probably have done
that. I was like, ooh.
You're like, do I need to edit this out?
No, totally no, fine. Yeah. I was like, me, I'm Jewish. I make like weird jokes all the time.
Yeah. So, I personally don't subscribe to that headcanon. Like I said, it's valid if you want to interpret that way. I get it. And if you see yourself in Darcy, I get it. That's totally cool and beautiful and wonderful. I just disagree. However, I connected so heavily to Catherine this last time I read Northanger Abbey. I was like, I see myself in her. Like, I'm just like,
That sounds like a dissertation. It could be. Sounds like a good TM trademark.
I need to write my own.
Like, it's probably, I'm sure someone's written a paper about that, right?
Maybe. Potentially. I don't know.
Okay, so Darcy pro, Darcy in.
Yeah, so I do like
Darcy. Everybody else out.
Kind of, let's see.
It's fair. I mean, men are garbage, though. Like we were saying, hard garbage men.
Like, Tilney, no. Okay, I like Colonel Brandon. I like Colonel Brandon.
Okay, fair.
Like, he's a problematic favorite because I do think, you know, he was in the army, he was in India. So, you know, colonizing force there, but problematic fave. I
but sort of makes him like a real person, right? Problematic. Yeah. Like, aren't we all?
Yeah. I love John Thorpe too. So I can't really talk, can I?
Yeah. Right. Oh yeah. John Thorpe. Number one hero. Justice for John Thorpe.
But yeah, I think in the latter half, there are no Austin men that main men that I really like. I hate Edmund. I'm not a fan of Wentworth. I don't get it. I'm sorry.
Yes, we're sisters in that way. Are we not fans for the same reasons though? Like,
probably
he is an asshole, right?
He's just an asshole, and
he doesn't get over himself.
He kind of does, and I think it's like it doesn't help that like Persuasion is pretty truncated. I think it kind of has the same issue as Northanger Abbey in that like it wasn't fully finished when Jane Austen passed away. So I feel like Wentworth doesn't, like, you don't see the change in him from before and after, right? Mm-hmm. You don't see him quite as much kind of overcoming his own pain. It's more like something you infer. And it doesn't help that we're just like so very much in Anne's head the whole time. But, you know, once again, I don't really get it with Wentworth. He writes a nice letter and that's kind of it. Yeah. And of course, I despise Knightley. So I like and two Austin men.
Edward Ferrars doesn't even rate a mention.
Absolutely not.
Oh. Okay. I like it. I think we have time for maybe one more hot take if you've got it.
Do I have one more hot take? I would say the hottest take, Persuasion 2022 is amazing. It's a good movie. It's great. It's wonderful. I'm sorry. People who don't like it are just wrong.
Yeah. No, we love it. Yeah. I started off not liking it. And the more I watch it and talk about it and think about it, the more I like it.
Somehow it's just so right. What are the things? Like, what are your top points of why you love it so much?
So first of all, I watched the other Persuasion adaptations.
The other ones suck. That's why.
No, it does not suck.
And because I didn't want it to have, I don't want to have like, you know, first encounter bias or whatever. So I actually watched the 95 one first, and I've watched the one with Rupert Penry Jones, whenever like 90s or 2000s when that came out. And so, you know, I watched those and I was like, this is kind of boring. And there's some questionable elements in them. I've screamed on Twitter about the circus in the 95 one. I don't get it.
Life is a circus, baby.
I mean, I like it. It's like my favorite part of the movie, but it is bizarre.
It is pretty unusual.
But, you know, like the second that Persuasion 2022 like started, I was like, I'm already immediately into it. I like the fourth wall breaking. I like the jokes. I like that they made it more comedic. Like, yeah, Persuasion is not very comedic. That's fine.
But it could be.
Whatever. Mm. If you want to take a comedic, I mean, we do that with all sorts of things, right? There's lots of films that are serious and then we make a comedic version of it, or vice versa. Like there's that Fresh Prince of Bel-Air that's like serious, you know, like, so just that itself isn't a deal breaker for me. And it's much more pleasant for me to watch. Mm-hmm. The cast is amazing. Great performances. I think, you know, you get the story of Persuasion. You get Anne's anguish very well. You get even Wentworth's anguish really comes across very well, more so than I got from the book personally. And yeah, I mean, I just thought it was a great way to bring that story to a 21st century audience. In the same way that I think, like, you know, 86 Northanger is a great way to bring the Gothic to, I guess, an 86 audience. You know, like, it's dynamic and interesting and engaging in ways that I did not find previous adaptations to be. And I will also be forthright and say that Persuasion is not my favorite Austen. So that might be it. I don't really hold it on a pedestal at all. Mm-hmm.
You're open to a different interpretation and viewpoint of the text.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Love it.
So, you know, and I was laughing. I was having a good time.
I want to watch it again right now.
Put it on. Throw it on. Yeah. Enjoy it. Have a good time. You know, whatever.
Yeah, I'm like, we're so the same in that way. Like, as you know, like it's not, I've asked myself so often, like, why am I so different than all these other Austin fans in that respect? But I think you and I both struggled, like you were saying, with the understanding Wentworth almost at all. And like you said, because we are in so much in Anne's head and we just see her pain and her anguish, to me, he just becomes the enemy. He just becomes the bad guy. Mm-hmm. Why would I want my beloved Anne to end up with this monster who's like breezes into town,
whoa,
under her nose, courts these other women, says all this crap about her? Yeah, I don't, you know, I know how awful it is to be in love with someone who can do nothing but put you down. And I want a different happy ending.
Exactly. And, you know, I'm
she should have ended up with Henry Golding, right?
Oh, yeah. Mr. Ellen. You just love Henry Golding.
I don't know what you're talking about. Everyone should be married to Henry Golding. Henry Golding or Renee Salt, whatever his name is from Bridgerton, right? That guy. Those are the only two men that are acceptable.
Yeah. What is this?
And Matt Berry. Yeah. Don't forget.
It's
Matt
French. Berry. It's something French, right? Ooh. Those are the only choices, ladies. Everyone else is trash. Kick them to the curb.
Oh my gosh, Matt Berry.
I agree.
Oh, and Matt Berry. Yes, Matt Berry. Sorry, my bad. We'll just all live together in a commune. And by all, I mean those three men and every woman.
Oh boy. Yeah. But
yeah. You're with every other woman too. So like, you'll have fun.
I'll be fine.
Yeah, totally.
But yeah, I'm definitely one of those people that like, when people come to me with relationship problems with their men, I'm always like, leave him. Like,
yeah. It's like an ask Carolyn, ask Lexi. It's like, dump the motherfucker already. That's what that's one of Dan Savage's. It's even an acronym where people write like, oh, I'm my boyfriend, blah, blah, blah. And he's like, dump the motherfucker already. Like, why are you still with this person? Exactly. It's just Lexi.
So then like, you know, you just see Anne hurting this whole time and being anguished. I'm like, I don't want you to be with this man.
Yeah. Why are you even, girl? Like, you can do better. Why are you even like wasting like, time?
She really can. If she just like got away from her terrible family, she wouldn't even have to marry her cousin and do incest. But she could just find a guy. There's Bennick.
Does Anne just need a sassy gay friend?
Maybe. What are you doing?
What are you doing? Will anybody even get this reference? Does anybody remember so Sassy Gay Friend?
Maggie, no one.
Oh my God. It. You were talking about 1986 as like trying to make it a modern adaptation. And I was like, that was almost 40 years ago. I know. And my soul left my body. I was like, oh boy. Okay.
I think that's also something. I think I might have tweeted this once. I was like, I think I just want to date Anne. Like, that's why I don't want to
be like, yeah, yeah, yeah. She's like, yeah, she would be so fun. Okay, it would be so fun to like take Anne out to a burlesque show and like give her some like fancy cocktails. That would be so fun. She'd have such a great time. Yeah. Oh, she'd love it. You know what? Nobody needs a girls' night out more than Anne.
It's so true.
And then you like out. Open her horizon.
Absolutely.
I'm into it.
We have a great connection. We travel the continent together. Mm-hmm. We have a beautiful relationship.
And what's the female version of confirmed bachelors?
Spinster? I don't know.
Just two lady spinsters.
Just two gals being pals. Just
gal pals. And they were roommates. This is my roommate.
Historically, in like the 20s, it was referred to as someone being someone's shadow. Oh, like, oh, Lady blah, blah, blah was out and with her shadow, meaning her like constant female companion.
Of course, Kristen knows the actual answer to this question.
It was actually discussed in The Making of Jane Austen by Devaney Loser, which is why this is where I learned it, which is
my question, though. It's like that is very dehumanizing of the other person.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So it's usually they're talking about it's in one of these columns, right? Like about famous people.
So you have to be like a lady so-and-so or someone super rich. And then the other person is like,
it's a shadow.
There can't be two.
Yeah.
Two hot rich ladies can't get together.
Which is unmarried women was just like, not even weird. I mean, there was just no power of choice, right? So it didn't have like that confirmed bachelor language other than being a spinster. So yeah, I would agree. That's probably what it was.
I mean, a lot of men didn't even think women could have sex together. Like it was physically impossible, which is hilarious.
So great. So any last things that you wanted to make sure to cover before we wrap
Do you want to do like a like what is it called in game shows where you just like boom 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 like throw them out, no discussion, just say them rapid fire.
Or
save them.
We could save them for the future. I could sit on them some more. I think there's some that are like I'll say probably like some lukewarm takes, like Austin clearly seem to have something to say about the clergy. Like, I don't think there's a single good clergyman in her stories.
Ooh, I guess that depends though on who you like. Cause someone would be like, Mr. Tilney or Edmund. But like, do you like them or no?
Importantly, the Watsons, that fragment, the clear, like good guys, the clergymen, but she never finished it.
Yeah. She was like, this sucks. And she just never finished it.
I don't agree with this.
I can't make the clergy the hero.
Totally unrealistic.
Maybe. Or there would have been like a face turn, right? Or like a reveal that he wasn't everything we thought he was or something. I don't know.
What if I ended up being like a world famous author through all of history and then someone just like dug out my old diaries or bullshit I wrote in school when I was in high school? That'd be so embarrassing.
Nightmare.
Like, the fragment. The like novel fragment. I was like, I wrote that at 3 a.m. on a Tuesday.
It's kind of how I feel about her juvenilia as well. Like, I haven't read very much of it, but it's like, she wrote this as a kid, man. Like,
it's just like
genius was obvious from the beginning. Like,
when we're looking at it historically, we want to digest and consume everything we can. But then if you think about it as you, it's like, I'd be cringing so hard.
Yeah.
If anybody read my stuff.
Nobody's got it worse than James Joyce, frankly.
Ooh.
Although maybe he would be into it. I don't know.
He was like, well, yes, I was always a genius.
No, man, you know what I'm talking about though, right?
I do not. I don't like James Joyce. Hot take, James Joyce is fucking boring.
Let me explain to you what I'm talking about.
So, I've read James Joyce wrote Portrait of the Artist, right?
Yes. And
read Portrait of the Artist of a Young Man at least 3 times in high school, college, and after, because each time I was like, surely I'm missing something. No, it was so boring. I read it and it immediately left my brain. And even to this day, I could not tell you anything about the plot. I do not remember it.
I do love Portrait of the Young Man, but
sorry to shit on something you like, Kristen.
Well, speaking of James Joyce, his papers, right? His private correspondence. That was his sexual fetish, right? So he wrote all of these letters to, I don't know, was it his wife, his girlfriend who later became his wife, with very explicit, detailed sexual fantasies involving passing gas, involving, defecating, and it's all out there.
Maybe I need to give James Joyce another try.
Man, this stuff is, and we shouldn't be, this is his private,
Yeah,
he was such a freak, frankly. I mean, I think he would have just embraced it because he was so, joyfully into this stuff, man. Like, he was really into it.
But it's sort of like once you become this level of stature and like a historical figure, it's like you are no longer entitled to any privacy. You're no longer entitled to any, which is why probably, I mean, Jane's letters were burnt, right? And we don't have them, because if we did, it is sad, but I can also understand.
So frustrated, but I can also understand. Sorry to interrupt you. It's exactly what I was going to say. Like, Cassandra had to protect her family Mm-hmm. And Jane's memory. And
as someone 200 years later, it's very sad.
That little twat, Fanny Austin Knight, hadn't burnt so many more, because those are the ones that Cassandra left for posterity. And we lost them probably because they had mentioned underwear or some shit that the Victorians couldn't handle. So, you know, screw that girl.
Yeah, fuck her. As someone 200, if she's impossible to fuck her, because two women can't possibly have sex together.
Wow, this has gotten really raunchy. Oh, man.
Slap that mature audience label.
Can I keep that James Joyce stuff in? Are people going to be like,
absolutely. Are people going to come at me, though?
I'm just going to put a warning, after
we talk shit about James Joyce.
After this timestamp, things get quite racy. Like, I don't know if you're listening to it in the car or you don't think you want to hear that. I'll just put a warning.
You may not want to have your baby listen. But I mean, we have an adult. We have a tag on our episodes already.
You know, that explicit tag doesn't wash all sins away.
those are James Joyce's sins as far as I'm concerned.
I mean, yeah, to be fair, it's not like you normally talk about this.
Not on air.
So I mean, the show doesn't normally discuss this.
No, stuff. I think you should leave it in. I think it's interesting because it leads into the idea, though, again, the legacy is not your own. You then become public. Not only are your works in the public domain, but your entire life becomes part of the public domain, and you aren't considered a person anymore, which is what I was kind of thinking. Like, at 200 years after the fact, I wish we had everything Jane Austen had ever written. But as a person who lives now, I would be horrified if people saw everything I had ever said.
Yeah. Man. Sometimes I think back and I'm just so glad there's no record of all of the dumb.
Well, thank God we grew up without social media.
I know.
Although I never said anything bad. I was perfect.
I'm sure you didn't. I'm sure you never had an embarrassing thought in your head, Maggie.
I just say every thought that's in my head. So. It's all out there.
I've had to delete some unfortunate thoughts that I decided to post to the internet for some ungodly reason.
Sometimes I'll start to tweet something and then I'll be like, because here's the thing. I do not think that I will ever go viral. Right. I think you have to be pretty, not narcissistic, but the chances that you would spark something are super, super low, but there's still always a chance. And so I don't want to poke the hornet's nest unnecessarily. Do you know what I mean? Especially with zero content moderation and things like that.
Oh God. Yeah. There absolutely is a chance. I think that's something, you said, it feels weirdly narcissistic thing. I can go viral because normally we're just talking to the same 15 weirdos that we've all connected to.
How dare you?
that's weirdo affectionately.
Right.
but it does happen. Just some nobody will get picked up in an algorithm somewhere.
Yeah.
And I think that's a kind of a power of the internet we really should be paying attention to. I don't know. This is definitely a tangent, but that doxing situation that happened on TikTok about the girl who was at the baseball game and she saw some girls that were making fun of her. That happened to, those girls went to my school.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
They attended my university.
Oh my God.
So that was wild.
Yeah.
How imminent that was. Yeah. And obviously the girl who posted that video didn't expect to go viral, but TikTok's algorithm picked it up and it became a whole situation.
Yeah.
And we got to be careful about that,
Well, sometimes Kristen and I worry about that too. I mean, we talk very openly about feminist stuff and things like that. And you never know who would one day be listening.
Well, the whole last podcast on here about how I'm fucking bipolar. I mean, it's a risk, And I sit around sometimes and I think, because my family doesn't listen to this podcast. That's the whole reason I have the podcast, because they don't want to hear me talk about Jane Austen. And I understand that. But, I've said things on this podcast that I wouldn't tell my mother or my sister. You know what I mean? They still don't know. And so
it's a weird public anonymity.
It's such a stretch to imagine someone listening to these picking up on something I said and then trying to destroy my life because of it, because a lot of it is just self-disclosure and nobody would be mad about that. So I think that it's okay to be honest. I mean, people could figure out my surname very easily if they wanted to because of the Facebook page, you know? They could just like look at who all is following it or whatever. Mm-hmm. Now I'm just like giving people.
Oh no, Kristen, you said too much.
But yeah.
And people know that I live in California.
Yeah, they really wanted to, they could. And so, but everybody has a podcast nowadays is the other thing. So unless it becomes something where I've said something that's going to discredit my university or something, I can't imagine it ever happening, but it does make me feel vulnerable for sure. Why am I talking about this? Am I making a point or am I just rambling at this
point?
Yeah,
I don't remember, but I like it.
Heart to heart. It's all good.
Sorry. Well, sometimes it's easier to, I mean, I process things by talking about them. So I share personal things like Bay would not be comfortable talking about all the time with people, because that's how I personally like work through things. And to hear that other people have gone through similar things is very helpful to me. And if you keep everything inside, you don't get that, like, you don't get that shared experience because you don't know what other people have gone through. But sometimes it's easier to talk about things with people you don't know than people you do know, which I think is kind of what you're saying, Kristen.
Yeah, exactly.
You don't have any baggage.
Well, and I have to tell you, like,
other people,
I said on the podcast a while ago that like my new friends in Portland or whatever, I didn't tell them that I have this podcast, even though I'm in a Jane Austen book club with them. And then the other day we had the Mansfield Park book club where they came over to my place and we talked about Mansfield Park. And it was a beautiful day. So like out of 8 people who said they were coming, like 5 of them canceled. They didn't cancel on me. They just went on the app, the meetup app. And they're like, no, I'm not coming after all. Which, so I get it. It's fine. And nobody likes Mansfield Park. I get it. It's fine. But the two women who did end up ultimately coming, I, of course, had just done all this literature searching to do the Mansfield Park movie podcast. And so I was like busting out all this knowledge. And then they were like, finally, they're like, why do you know all of this?
My secret life has been exposed.
And at that point, it felt like a straight up lie to say. So I said I was just on a podcast about it. And then, of course, they were really interested. And so I end up telling them about it. And now one of them is listening to it. And
hi. Hey, girl. Hey.
Yeah, I don't know how far she's going to go, but you know what I mean? Like, she said she has started episode 4.
I promise you, she did not make it past the sexual fantasies involving defecation discussion. Maybe, but that just shows you how different we are, because I am like waiting for the opportunity to tell people I have a podcast because I think it's cool.
Yeah, that's great. So every casual acquaintance you've ever made knows about my
I give them our card. You give them our card. We do have cards. So I had cards made for us when we went
to Jasna.
Yeah, to Jasna, so we could give them to people, and they're very cute. But like, no. But I'll just, if people are talking about a podcast, or a couple times at work, people like, there needs to be someone who steps up to do a public speaking kind of thing, and I'll be like, well, I don't mind doing it. You know, like I co-host a podcast. I'm comfortable talking in front of people. Oh, you have a podcast? Was it? It's about Jane Austen. And they're like, ooh. The girls are like, ooh. And the boys are like, oh.
That's so real.
Yeah. Okay. We have lost the plot.
I know. I was just going to ask Lexi, like, one last final question. And that is, like, in this season of your life, right? Like, we're still talking about Austen every day. Like, What would you say that it means to you? What would you say that Jane Austen is still contributing to your life?
I mean, you know, it's part of it is just how relevant all her works still are. Yeah, like, you know, every time you read it, you're like, you can see your current life in her work. You know, it's so universal in a way that almost no other work is. And part of it is, you know, it's comforting to me. I have been reading Jane Austen for 15-ish years now or something like that. And before that, you know, I watched the movies and stuff. So, you know, I've kind of grown up with her. I've come of age with her. you know, she's kind of like that, I guess, force in my life that has kind of always, not like directed me or anything like that, but she's always been there. You know, she's always been that interest and that love and that passion. Part of that's the reason why I'm so passionate about history is because of Austin. Part of the reason I'm so passionate about literature is because of Austin. Mm-hmm. You know, like I work for my university as a tutor for theology and history. But if a professor, an English professor, has assigned an Austin work, my boss gives those students to me because I know Austin more than the other English tutors.
That's so awesome.
You know, like she is a central part of my being, you know, like there's a few things in my life where I'm like, this is my identity and she is part of that. So
yeah, 100%.
I love that.
And that beautiful note. Should we say good? We don't have a wheat sheaf. We don't have a mailbag or anything to do. So I think we are ready to say goodnight. Lexi, do you want to do our sign off? It is, we have delighted you long enough.
Well, first we have to say thank you.
Oh yeah, yeah, of course.
Yeah, thank you, Lexi. Thank you for God, you're so rude.
Hopefully I would have said thank you like after we stopped.
Yeah, Lexi, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. This was so fun. I loved hearing your hot takes, which just like on a key, totally reframed a lot of things for me. It was so interesting. Thank you so much for your time and for sharing your knowledge.
Thank you for having me and for legitimizing my hot takes on this platform.
Oh yeah. You're so welcome for the validation.
It's forever now.
Your hot takes have changed my mind, enriched my life.
Yes, and I totally I'm so completely changed. For you. I think I've changed as a person, as a woman, and as a mother.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's quite the impact I've had, I guess.
No, and I didn't mean just today. I meant like through our friendship and following you on Twitter and all of the interesting things you're always saying. So yes. Thank you for that as well.
All right. So Lexi, do you want to take us home?
Absolutely. Gentle listeners, we have delighted you long enough.
Bye.
Bye.